Hi, and welcome to the Renew Ministries podcast. We're so thankful that you chose to listen to us today, and we pray that you are blessed by this message by Pastor Pam Otten.
Lamp here that was in this video. On July 1, 1857, a businessman named Jeremiah Lamphere took up an appointment as a city missionary in downtown New York. He was already known in the New York community as a businessman who handed out tracts. Lamphere was appointed by the North Church of the Dutch Reformed denomination. How's that? This church was suffering from decreasing membership due to the population moving from the downtown to the more prosperous outlying areas. The new city missionary of the Dutch Reformed Church was hired to visit the immediate neighborhood to try and increase church attendance among the population of the lower city. Is this striking a chord with anybody? After several months of no success, Jeremiah Lamphere decided to invite others to join him in a noonday prayer meeting to be held on Wednesdays once a week. He distributed a flyer. You heard these, that he distributed 20,000 flyers that said this: "How often shall I pray?" A day prayer meeting is held every Wednesday from 12 to 1 o'clock in the consistory building in the rear of the North Dutch Reformed Church on the corner of Fulton and William Streets in New York. This meeting is intended to give merchants, mechanics, clerks, strangers, and businessmen generally an opportunity to stop and call upon God amid the perplexities incident to their respective avocations. It will continue for 1 hour, but it is also designed for those who may find it inconvenient to remain more than 5 or 10 minutes, as well as for those who can spare the whole hour. So as it said in the video, at noon on September 23, 1857, he opened the door and he waited for the response to his invitation. 5 minutes went by. Nobody appeared. The missionary paced the room in a conflict of fear and faith, and you know what that's like, right? 10 minutes elapsed. Still no one came. 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 25, 30, and then 30 minutes at 12:30 p.m., a step was heard on the stairs, and the first person appeared, then another, and another, and another, until 6 people were present, and the prayer meeting began. Humble beginnings, right? In the first week of October 1857, it was decided to hold a meeting daily instead of weekly. Within 6 months, 10,000 businessmen were gathering daily for prayer in New York. And within 2 years, 1 million converts were added to the American churches. The greatest revival in New York's history was sweeping the city, and it made the whole nation curious. Prayer meetings spread across the country to many other states. There was simply an incredible movement among the lay people to pray. So I titled this message, Perseverance to the End, and I want to talk about perseverance tonight, what that is, and why we need it. And let me say, first of all, that every great movement of God, every revival that has ever happened, many people have studied revivals, they all start the same way, with one person, one passionate Christ follower praying. That's how they all start. Every great movement of God also requires persistence and perseverance to stay the course and to complete the great work that God has given us to do. So, as I said, I titled this message Perseverance to the End, because perseverance is not just for a short period of time. It's not something that you have and then you don't need later. It's something that we as Christians are going to need until the day we die, or until the day Jesus comes to take us all home to heaven. So here's the definition of perseverance. It's defined as a steady persistence in a course of action, a purpose, or a state, especially in spite of difficulties, obstacles, or discouragement. So Nehemiah showed great perseverance in his calling to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. In Nehemiah 6, we see more opposition, of course, more opposition to the rebuilding of those walls around the city of Jerusalem. So I'm going to take some time to look at Nehemiah 6 and just parts of Nehemiah 7. First of all, in Nehemiah 6, it's titled Further Opposition to the Rebuilding. In other words, this is not the first time, probably not the last. So we're going to see a series of difficulties in this chapter, which come out as distractions and as discouragements. And then we're going to see Nehemiah show great discernment in how he responds to those difficulties. So let's talk about difficulties for just a minute. When God is doing a great work through us, what can we expect?
Change.
Can we expect difficulties?
Mm-hmm.
We can expect difficulties because the enemy's going to take notice, right? If God is doing a great work in us, the enemy's going to pay attention. He'll gladly leave us alone if we're not being effective for the kingdom. But the minute we start doing something that is a great work, he's going to pay attention and try and stop us. So we can expect things are going to get difficult. And ultimately, what he wants, of course, is for us to what? Quit. Right?
Yeah.
Quit. Stop. And he will use every tactic that he can think of to try and get us to do that. So he will try something. If that doesn't work, then he'll try something else, and he'll just keep picking at it until he can try and get us to either, number one, not be effective anymore, or to stop completely. So let's see what happens with Nehemiah. So what I'm going to do is, the scripture is going to be up on the screen, and I'm going to talk about distractions, his discernment, discouragements, his discernment, in that order. So distraction number one starts with verse 1. When word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies, these guys are not new to us that have been in this series, enemies of Nehemiah. When word got to them that I had rebuilt the wall and there was not a gap left in it, though up to that time I had not put the doors and the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message. Come. Let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. Nehemiah was making great progress, right? So the enemies are going to take notice. And they decided it was time to do something. So they try to get Nehemiah to stop working by inviting him to a meeting. Now, of course, this meeting was not going to take place on Nehemiah's turf. It's not going to take place in Jerusalem. The whole point of it is to get him to stop working for a period of time. So they invite him to a meeting that is outside of Jerusalem. Obviously, that's going to serve well to distract him. Here's Jeremiah's discernment, verse 2. But they were scheming to harm me, and he knew it. So I sent messengers to them with this reply. I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? In other words, I have work to do, people. Four times they sent him the same message, really? Four times. Sent him the same message, and each time he gave him the same answer. Can't do it. Got good work, got great work to do. So that was distraction number one. Distraction number two starts in verse 5. Then the fifth time, Sanballat sent his aide to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter in which was written. Now, you have to know what that means when they send an unsealed letter. That means it's public. Anybody that comes in contact with this letter is able to read it because it's not sealed. So now they have upped the ante. In other words, before they were sending just private messages. Now they're sending unsealed envelopes, so to speak, so that it becomes known by anybody that wants to or cares to read it what's going on. So in this unsealed letter in which was written, it is reported among the nations, and Geshem says this is true, so of course it must be true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt. And therefore, you are building the wall. Of course you're plotting to revolt, because why else would you build a wall for protection? Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah. In other words, you have gotten prophets to actually prophesy that you are going to be the king of Judah. Now this report is going to get back to the king. That's a problem for you, Nehemiah. So come, let us meet together. In other words, let's talk about this and let's have a little negotiation here because, you know, we know what we can do. We know what lies we can tell. We can get away with it. So we are just going to threaten you with the king finding out, and that will not go well for you. Which in a way is a little surprising to me because it's like Nehemiah was cupbearer to the king. So I'm not real sure why they bothered to threaten him with the king, but that's what they did. So here's his discernment in verse 8. I sent them this reply. Nothing like what you are saying is happening. Nothing. It's not happening. You're just making this up out of your own head. And they were all trying to frighten us. Notice here, enemy tactics, trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak. They'll be scared, and then their hands will physically get too weak for the work, and so they won't finish it. But I prayed. Here's his discernment. He knows what to do. He prays. And he says, strengthen my hands. In other words, if I am feeling weak emotionally, physically, strengthen my hands. So they up the ante again. In verse 10, here comes discouragement number one. One day I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut in at his home. Now think about this. This guy is shut in. He's in his home. He said, let us meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you. Think that might be a little discouraging? Men are coming to kill you. And by night, they're coming to kill you. In other words, under cover of darkness, when you don't see them coming, they are coming to kill you. So here's Nehemiah's response in verse 11. His discernment. But I said, should a man like me run away? Or should someone like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go. Nehemiah knew what he was appointed to do from God directly. He knew what his job was, and he knew that God would protect him. Verse 12 says, I realized that God had not sent him, but that he had prophesied against me because these enemies, Tobiah and Sanballat, had hired him. He had been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin. In other words, so that Nehemiah would commit a sin by doing this, by believing it and running away. And then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. In other words, they're trying to get him to run away in fear of possibly being killed, so that they could spread the word around that Nehemiah is not doing what he's supposed to be doing. Pretty tricky. Verse 14, this is Nehemiah talking now. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, my God, because of what they have done. Remember also the prophet Noadiah and how she, notice the she, prophet, and the rest of the prophets have been trying to intimidate me. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. Think about this. A wall completely around the city of Jerusalem, completed in 52 days. Now, that might not seem like a great feat nowadays with all the equipment and all the things that we, tools and things that we have to build something like that, but they're literally building this thing with their bare hands and rocks. And they did it. That's how many people they had helping build this thing, taking sections of the wall in order to get it done in 52 days. I would say that that's a God miracle. But here comes verse 16, opposition to the completed wall. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. In other words, unless God was in this, it could not have happened, and certainly could not have happened in 52 days. But wait, they're not done yet. Here comes discouragement number 2 in verse 17. Also in those days, the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah. In other words, nobles of Judah. These are God's people sending letters to an enemy. And replies from Tobiah kept coming to them. For many in Judah were under oath to them, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah, son of Era, and his son Jehohanan, had married the daughter of Meshulam, son of Berechiah. Intermarriage, right? We've heard this before. They were told not to do it. They clearly were still doing it, even though they knew they weren't supposed to. And therefore, alliances were formed that were not of God. Verse 19, moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds. In other words, Tobiah's good deeds. And then telling him what I said about them. And Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me. Now, if you are a leader in, or any of the leaders of this movement that is happening, there is probably not anything more discouraging than to find out that people are deliberately undermining you and talking about you and spreading things about you to somebody who is a known enemy. So I can see that this could potentially be extremely discouraging to Nehemiah. But what does he do? This is really interesting because in Nehemiah 7, the next chapter, we see his discernment. This is his response. Basically, he ignores what they're doing, completely ignores it. And in chapter 7, he determines who has the right to be set apart as God's protected people. Think about that. He is the one who's being attacked. And what does he do? He spends his time making sure that the people of God are protected. So verse 1, after the wall had been rebuilt and I had set the doors in place, the gatekeepers, the musicians, and the Levites were appointed. I put in charge of Jerusalem my brother Hanani, along with Hananiah, the commander of the citadel, because he was a man of integrity and feared God more than most people do. I said to them, the gates of Jerusalem are not to be opened until the sun is hot, a protective measure. While the gatekeepers are still on duty, have them shut the doors and bar them. Also appoint residents of Jerusalem as guards, some at their posts and some near their own houses. So then, I'm not going to show this all on the screen, but in this section is a literal list of the exiles who returned. Verse 4, now the city was large and spacious, but there were few people in it. We're talking about Jerusalem now. And the houses had not been rebuilt. So far, we have the temple being rebuilt. We have the walls around the city rebuilt, but none of the houses for the actual people who are going to live in Jerusalem rebuilt. So people had been living in the towns in the outlying areas. So God put it into my heart to assemble the nobles, the officials, and the common people for registration by families. I found the genealogical record of those who had been the first to return. And this is what I found written there. These are the people of the province who came up from the captivity of the exiles, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had taken captive. They returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his own town. And then after that, I'm skipping a whole long section, which is all names. Feel free to look it up and try and pronounce them all. It's all the different people that came to be registered and that were in the records as having first come. So verse 66 says, the whole company numbered 42,360, besides their 7,337 male and female slaves. And they also had 245 male and female singers. As a musician, I find it really interesting that they separately named the people that had the skill and talent of singing. There were 736 horses, 245 mules, 435 camels, and 6,720 donkeys. And then verse 73, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the musicians, and the temple servants, along with certain of the people and the rest of the Israelites, settled in their own towns. So again, Nehemiah responds to discouraging news by not only ignoring it, but also the people are attempting to intimidate him, right? So he ignores it, and he does it by making sure that the people of God are kept set apart, because this is what God had commanded them to do at that time. They needed to be holy and set apart. And he was protecting the people of God by making sure that everyone was registered and accounted for. And the Bible says that God did this, that he kept them set apart, holy, set apart to him, so that he could bless them to be a blessing. Isn't that interesting? Bless them because he wanted to make sure he was blessing the right people to be a blessing in the world. So I have one more example of perseverance that I want to show you tonight. And I'm going to intro this short video. Pastor Al and Chrissy Toledo are the son-in-law and daughter of Jim Cimbala, who is pastor of the Brooklyn Tabernacle in New York. The Brooklyn Tabernacle has its own amazing story of how it began, but I wanted to show you tonight how God worked in the lives of Al and Chrissy to start the Chicago Tabernacle. Their story is more recent. It began back in 2002, and they have been in at least three different locations since then in Chicago, finally landing at their current location in 2015, which is an old renovated theater space on Cicero Avenue, where they now have three Sunday morning services, as well as a weekly prayer meeting, impacting thousands of people every week. Now, our ministry model here at Renew may not be the same as theirs, and our needs may be different, but please do not miss the amazing God miracles that God provided for them exactly when they needed it.
We decided to take a trip to Chicago, and then the Lord, while we came, we were just trying to get some rest, the Lord started to do some unique things.
We're, you know, eating at local restaurants downtown, staying at the hotel, and it was like three or four people, key people, that were indicators that this isn't just a getaway trip. I said, do you think we're supposed to start a church here? Like, that's something we've always wanted to do, haven't we, Al? We've always wanted to pioneer work that we can build on prayer, that we can build on our convictions, what the Word of God says, and kind of start with fresh ground. I turned to him and I said, what do you think about starting a church? And he's like, are you serious? I mean, our children are living near our both sets of grandparents. We're serving at the Brooklyn Tabernacle. I mean, who wouldn't want to work there? And he was assisting my dad. I was helping with the choir.
We were driving. I could see the Chicago skyline. She's asking me questions, saying, what do you think? And I'm thinking, she's crazy, you know. But the Lord began to really deal with me. And then I started to pray and started to, you know, go to people that I really respect. I remember one time in particular calling Mike Messner. He said, you know, Chicago needs a church that has been really birthed in prayer and that will be built on prayer. And after that conversation, it really started to just become settled in my heart. And then one morning, very early in the morning, I was praying and the Lord just gave me a promise and basically said that as soon as we got to Chicago, there were going to be resources for us to start. Wouldn't be a lot. The picture that I had in my mind was that we were going to have sticks to be able to rub together and cause a fire. We got a call from this small group of people who had tried to launch this church, and it just never went. I just told them, I'm not interested in taking over a church. I said, but we are going to start a church if you guys want to throw in with us. And I think it was like February 17th, like within 30 days, we had a small group of people in the Chicago Tabernacle. The group that said that they would throw in with us, they were meeting in the basement of a church. But being there just a couple of weeks, we knew that we had to get out of there because it was so bad that there was no one you could invite to that place. We started to search for another place to meet, and because we had to get out of there. And so we started to look all over the city for this new place. We had no money in the bank. Our church was literally 8 weeks old. And so Chrissy called a real estate agent. We started to look around, and that's when we walked into 4201 North Troy.
Any price would have been too much when you don't have any money. I think they were asking $660,000. And I said to my husband, you know what? That's too much money. We can't afford that. But $550,000, we can afford.
But the real estate agent heard, overheard, and said to her, you will never get this building for less than $600,000. So we went to prayer meeting. We gave the mic to someone, one of our deacons, and he prayed and he said, God, we need a building. We need a down payment. We need a mortgage, and we need it fast. The following day, we got a reply from the real estate agent that they had come down to $550,000. We brought it to the church that Sunday morning. We were thinking we might get $3,000 or $4,000 pledged, and they pledged $27,000 that morning. Providentially, we were scheduled to fly to Springfield, Missouri to speak at a church called James River Assembly. And then at the end of the service, the pastor took an offering for our work. They gave me a check for $41,000 that night. The head of the Assemblies of God was in that meeting and said, we're going to give you a mortgage. AG Financial gave us a mortgage. In 7 days, we had a building, we had a down payment, we had a mortgage. We moved in starting in June of that year. As we just kept, we had nothing. As we kept praying and seeking the Lord, he kept sending help and support. And it was just another one of those moments where, because we called upon the Lord, he just delivered us.
Alan likes to tell the story that when they first came to Chicago, and he was talking about that they had this church group that was meeting in a basement of a church. And the reason that they were meeting in the basement of that church was it was the only functional at all space in the church. And they had an electrician in their group, and every Sunday morning he would go outside and jerry-rig the electric on the outside of the building so they would have power in the building for the few hours that they were there. That's how bad it was. And so when he says we couldn't invite people there, it was a building that really needed to be condemned and probably may even have been condemned, I don't know. But he also likes to tell that they started the Chicago Tabernacle with six people. And it's really amazing what God will do if we just pray. And if we just persevere and don't give up. I mean, God will do it. He will do it. And he's no respecter of persons. That's biblical. What he has done for other people, he will do for us. And so, as I said, our ministry model may not be the same, and our needs may not be the same. But I think at this point that it's very important that we persevere, that we don't give up, that we believe that our God is still doing miracles today, and that he is willing to give us and provide us with everything that we need. He will do it for us too. Walter Elliott, a prominent Scottish politician in the early 1900s, said this. He said, perseverance is not a long race. It's many short races after the other. And if I have learned anything in this last year, that is it. Perseverance is a lot of short races, and it seems like just when you get one thing done, another thing needs to happen, right? So we've had a wonderful victory in the last couple of weeks of being officially approved as a church plant within the RCA. That was a race for us that lasted almost a year, and that was a struggle. But there are new things, right? There are new challenges, there are new decisions, there are important things. There's always going to be things that we need to look to the Lord, that we need to pray about and discern, just like Nehemiah did. Nehemiah always prayed first. And he knew what God had promised him, and he was not afraid to ask God to do what he said he would do. So, I think that that Galatians 6, verse 9. I've used this verse often, but I'm going to say it again. Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time, we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. So tonight, I think because we have a smaller number here, I think it's a good thing for us to spend some time in prayer and to pray about perseverance. I think we all have things individually that we may need perseverance for, things that we may have been struggling with, things that we're crying out to God to do a miracle, for whatever that might be, and certainly for Renew Ministries as well. We have important decisions that we need to make, and perseverance is something that we definitely need.